Today in Studio 360, Terrence Winter's new show is all about the record business. And you couldn't ask for a better technical consultant. Too bad he can't always be on set.
You know, dude's touring schedule is often not physically present.
Oh, yeah, he's in a band.
Yeah, he's got a little side gig he does.
How Mick Jagger helps vinyl get rock and roll right. And Martin Scorsese directing the first episode doesn't hurt either. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start the show, back when Jimmy Carter was president, a little-known Australian director named George Miller made his first super low-budget movie. It starred a little-known Australian actor named Mel Gibson.
Booby-trapped. Touch those tanks and...
But Mad Max was a hit, and Miller's vision became the blueprint for post-apocalyptic life. Now Miller is 70, and he has resurrected the franchise he invented. In Mad Max Fury Road, a warrior, played by Charlize Theron, is running from a tyrannical warlord.
She thinks she can lose us, Dad!
Like all the Mad Max movies, it is high on epic action and low on dialogue. And it's up for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. And its director, George Miller, joins me now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
You grew up and became a doctor, went to medical school along with your twin brother in Australia. So, Dr. Miller, how did you leave that a perfectly respectable career to do this?
It was never intentional. I'm always fond of quoting that John Lennon line, life is what happens when you make other plans. And it's definitely true. In my case, I always wanted to be a doctor. I enjoyed being a doctor. But at the same time, I was, when I was at medical school, you were very much more free to explore things. And I was very interested. I did a lot of painting. I did a lot of drawing. And I suddenly became interested in cinema at a time when you couldn't really have a career. There were no movies being made in Australia to speak of, at least by Australians. And then just as I was graduating, I got a chance to make a short film. And I immediately got hooked. And at that time, there were a lot of people making short films in Australia, and there's a whole cohort of people who were just basically driven by enthusiasm. And they included, the likes of Peter Weir and Bruce Beresford and the likes. And suddenly an industry emerged, and I got caught up in that, always with the intention of going back and working as a doctor. I kept working as a doctor while I was making films, basically to earn a living. For about a decade. And then after...
Really?
Yeah.
So I could have been in Australia and my doctor was the director of Mad Max?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I stayed working as a doctor because you had to have a doctor on set if you're doing stunts.
And I guess with a low-budget film, that makes
and
sense.
And a low-budget film, that was the case. And then it got to the stage where I went through with my twin brother, and as time went on, I realized I was forgetting the practice of it, and he's a very good doctor, and I realized I was just falling away from it. So, but by about the mid 80s, I no longer practiced or was registered as a doctor.
So, what made, if there's an answer to this, the young Mad Max auteur, when he got to middle age, create Babe and Happy Feet and another Happy Feet? I mean, we all are people of many parts, but those two things don't seem like natural brothers.
Well, they don't on the surface of it, but a very simple answer to that. I had kids.
You're no longer
going to the movies because it's hard to suddenly spontaneously, let's go and see a movie. So you're watching endless kids' films. And also I really was interested in the technology. The first Babe, it took a while before the digital technology came along and we could actually make the pigs talk.
Move along there, you big buttheads!
And I really remember the moment when Andrew Lesney, who shot the Babe movies, came back from The Lord of the Rings. He was a cinematographer on those movies, and he showed me the first motion capture of Gollum that Peter Jackson and everyone was doing there. And I remember I saw that already having the story of Happy Feet and said, we can make the penguins dance. So I became, it was wonderful to work with these new tools. Now my kids are grown up and I can go back to Mad Max movies.
No, I figured as much. Something like that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this new Mad Max film, which is essentially a 2-hour car chase. And as I was watching it, it felt so visceral and unusually real compared to a lot of what one sees in movies. And I guess that's because you actually did and shot all this. There wasn't that much digital computer-generated trickery, right?
There was CG involved in enormous number of shots, but it was always supportive of the real-world stuff.
Right.
In other words,
Cleaning up a bit?
Yeah, and particularly harnesses. We had a lot of actors in the stunts and the stunt.
Hanging off vehicles.
And nowadays you can put them on very, very secure harnesses and make sure that they're not going to – nothing untoward's going to happen. And we were able to change landscape. You're able to – the tire tracks, after you've done take one or two or three, you have to erase the previous takes and things like that. We could change skies. We could change landscape and things like that. So there's quite a deal of visual effects, but they were never
That's like makeup. That's post-production opposed to making the image.
But this is a film that didn't defy the laws of physics. There were no flying men or spacecraft. So if you're going to go out into the desert and have two vehicles colliding, why do it artificially, particularly with all the chaos of the dust and so on? It was much better to do it for real when you could. And it turned out over time we were able to do, even if you remember those guys on the poles.
Yes.
I thought initially the physics of that was going to be too dangerous to have, vehicles at speed with guys up there kind of swinging like pendulums up on very high poles. But the stunt crew, rigging crew figured it out how to do it, the effects crew. And
must have been fun for those guys. I mean, because it was so, again, an actual mechanical analog problem.
And exactly. And, it was fun. We even got Tom Hardy up on top of one.
Who's Mad Max.
Yeah, and quite safely, even though he did point out once he got up on top that he was afraid of heights. And so I said, okay, we'll do one or two takes and get you down, and he was able to do that. But it's not a fantasy film in that sense.
Right.
It's real world.
Right. Yeah. And how fast were those cars going?
It really depended on the shot and the location. If it was on hard stand road, they could go fairly fast, 120 kilometers an hour,
75 miles an hour. And was part of the intention and idea that, this people will subconsciously know this is real, therefore they will enjoy it more and be more scared and adrenaline will pump better and all that?
That was definitely part of it. I think if we had taken something that you can see in real world, at least you can see it on YouTube or on the news, if it was not real, it would look artificial. And I think we read that very quickly. I mean, we certainly read it. We know in human faces, and it's very hard to recreate the human face, and we know about the uncanny valley and so on. I think that same thing applies. Our brain is very efficient at reading things very quickly. So the moment we see something artificial, we acknowledge its artificiality.
It took a long time to make, a dozen years or more, and you had lots of obstacles deciding where to shoot, and will it be Namibia or Australia or somewhere else, and floods and war and lots of things got in your way. Was there ever a serious moment where you thought like, nah, this isn't going to happen and it's not worth it to try to make it happen at this point?
Look, it happens with all films that things get in the way, and sometimes the planets never align. But there's something about this film that you almost couldn't kill with a stick, no matter what got in its way.
Uh-huh.
It somehow kept on being resurrected. I mean, it was greenlit three times by three different studios.
Wow.
And I mean, I thought at a certain point when it was rained out of Australia, unprecedented rains came to the center of Australia, Broken Hill, where we actually shot the second two movies, and suddenly it was a flower garden where there was meant to be a desert.
After years of drought, too.
Yeah, yeah. And so we waited. Warner said, let's wait 18 months or 12 months, see if it dries up. It didn't. And so we picked everything up and went all the way to the southwest coast of Africa, Namibia, where it never rains, you know, guaranteed desert.
The editor, Margaret Sixel, who usually edits documentaries, except when she works for you,
yeah.
Why do you hire her, other than the fact that you're married to her?
Well, it had I not been married to her, I wouldn't know what she was capable of. But she's somebody who's got a very rigorous mind. She's got a very low boredom threshold, so hates repetition.
Uh-huh.
And is very mindful of that very careful orchestration, having a strong causal relationship, one shot to the next. It's not just stringing shots together. And that was very important because there was a great risk that the film could look like every other action movie, where it's a lot of sound and a lot of, you know, dazzling action.
And leading toward the stunt as a punchline after a punchline. To me, so many chase scenes, that kind of action film is just, you know, there are going to be six big explosion cars turnover, and the rest is just filler getting from one to the next.
Yes. One of the things this film we tried not to do is to have the talky bits followed by the action bits.
Yes.
We were trying to conflate the two. Yeah. And she was very aware that each moment in some way had to inform you of character, relationship of characters, and so on and so on.
And being married to your editor, whom, as you've described, is the editor on any good editor on a film is a close collaborator. So how does that work? Is it good for the marriage, bad for the marriage, better for the editing than if you weren't married to her? I mean, how does that dynamic
work? Well, in this case, I wouldn't normally recommend it, but in this case, it got to the point, you know, where it gets to be gobbledygook to you after a while. You see it over and over again.
Yes.
It got to the point where I could completely trust her judgment. Normally, in the editing room, I was the one who'd say, okay, this is what feels right for me. That should it be. But if I lost my way, it's the first time where if ever I lost my way, I would say, okay, you go where you think it should go and see. I don't quite understand what you're getting at, but show me. And she would say it. Do it, and I'd say, oh, okay, I didn't see what you saw, but you're absolutely right. That happened over and over again. And she was not afraid to say it to me. She would say, George, you're wrong. I'm here to avoid you embarrassing yourself, and would be able to reason it out.
You're 70. I am not a young man either. And one thinks of, okay, this is much, how much time is left. This is what – I don't want to spend my time doing that, but this and this and this, I'd like to get done.
Yes, there's definitely that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stories. Yeah, I've got many more stories than I have time to tell.
Yes.
But that's what I'm saying. You sort of line them up and you play them in your mind and you say, there's something about that one. If I have just one choice, which is the one I'll tell? And usually there's one of those that emerges. For better or for worse. That there's no, like, plan.
But I would think, for instance, like, maybe not another Mad Max. I mean, maybe not another Happy Feet.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be making another Happy Feet. I have two other stories for Mad Max, which are in script form, and probably not as the next film, but the film after. I would like to do one of them.
And you couldn't. Or could you imagine saying, okay, here's my stories that I've created for other Mad Maxes, but you, Guy, you be the director.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah?
There's so many directors out there that are, you know, people are directing younger and younger. They're getting a real sense of cinema very, very early. And there's some great directors out there.
So you let your child, the Mad Max child, marry one of these people.
Yeah, of course.
Good. Yeah. George Miller, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks very much, Kurt.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
I talked with George Miller just before the Academy Award nominations were announced, so I asked if he expected to get one. He thought not, but I'll bet you $50.
All right, we'll do it.
All right.
We'll do it. Australian dollars or American dollars?
I don't know what Australian dollars means.
Make it American dollars and I'll win more.
All right. Of course, Mad Max Fury Road is up for Best Picture, Best Director, and a whole bunch of other Academy Awards. 10. And much to my absolute delight and surprise, right after the nominations were announced, I got an email from George Miller asking how he could get the $50 to me. By the way, my conversation with George Miller was wonderful and rambling and long, and you can hear it in full as part of our special Director's Cut podcast series. Every week from now until Oscar weekend, we're releasing my conversations with each of the five nominated Best Directors. You can get that as part of the Studio 360 podcast feed on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, even rock stars have to deal with unsolicited advice from their mothers.
You can, you know, wear something different and something nicer. Okay, please call me back. You're impossible.
No matter how old and successful you get, she's still your mom. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Relationships with your parents can get complicated. Maybe they always get complicated, but especially if they were raised in one country and then you grew up in another. Laura Lee Rodriguez is an electronica musician who is getting a lot of buzz now, but her mother had a very different idea of how her daughter's career would unfold.
Buenos días, mi muchachita. ¿Cómo está? ¿Cómo amaneció? Mándeme el número de la cuenta para ir a hacer el depósito.
Oh, she wants to give me some money. She's so cute.
Mándeme el número de cuenta.
She's like, so, I can't.
La, 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 la.
Hi, I'm Laura Lee Rodriguez, and I go by Empress of. I make music.
Can I make it clear? You are everything. Everything is you.
I'm from Los Angeles, and I'm a first-generation American. Both of my parents are from Honduras. My parents came to the U.S. about 30 years ago. They just, like, wanted to have, like, a stable job and to, like, support their family. And my mom has been a nanny my whole life. And she's the hardest working woman, like, ever. I don't know. And she just had all these, like, aspirations for me. So she, like, learned English by, like, watching TV and the news and stuff. And so she wanted me to be a news anchor and have a bob haircut and wear a suit. That's, like, to my mom, that was the highest thing that you could do. And I was like, yeah, that sounds sick. I get to be on TV all day talking about stuff to people. We got a computer in our house, and I just started downloading a bunch of music. And I saw something on TV about Bjork, like, wearing a swan dress. And I looked up her catalog, and I was like, holy this is so weird. I don't know. And so different. So different from, like, listening to salsa or reggaeton in the house, you know? When I found Bjork, I was just like, this is very, I don't know, it's like so unique and so herself. And like, I look at Bjork and I'm like, she is herself. In my head, I was like, I'm gonna be a rock star. I'm gonna be like the weirdest person I can possibly be. And then I like convinced my mom to let me go to an arts high school. Because I was like, Mom, if you don't let me go to this arts high school, I'm going to go to this really ghetto public school and probably get pregnant when I'm like 15, like all the other girls in my town. And then she was like, okay, go. My mom was like really hoping that it was a hobby. When I was 17 and I told her that I was going to do music as a career, she cried. I didn't even tell her about Empress Of until like after I put out my first EP. I was scared to tell her. I like talked to my manager and I was like, I gotta tell my mom about this because I'm going on tour for like 2 months. I was like, Mom, I'm a producer and I make, you know, electronic music and I sing. And she was like, what do you mean? I was like, yeah, I'm like make songs and I put them out on the internet and people like them. I don't know, it was hard. It was like really, really hard for her because she knew like how difficult my life was gonna be. You gotta be crazy to wanna be an artist because it's impossible. And, like, I'm not, like, some privileged person who, like, grew up with a bunch of money. So to be a musician and live in New York, it's like, I'm crazy. I am crazy. Now she's, like, 100% behind it. She hasn't had, like, a lot of room in her life to be creative, you know? So she, like, does it through me. To have those conversations with her now... it's like really special, you know? Even like the criticism, when she criticizes my music, it's really funny. She's like, Larly, what are you talking about in these songs? Like, they make no sense. She's like, Larly, you need fancy dresses. She wants me to look like Shakira on stage.
You can, you know, wear something different and something nicer. Okay, please call me back. You're impossible right now.
She wants to go to everything that I do. I came to LA to play like this show with Jamie XX and John Hopkins. And she's like, cool, put me on the list for tonight. First of all, her saying that is like ridiculous. Secondly, I was like, absolutely not. You can't come. It's a rave. And she was like, no, I'm going to come. I was like, first of all, you're like 60 and like, you know, people are going to be doing drugs and stuff. And like, it's going to be loud and it's going to be in the desert. Okay, this is the day. This is the day when I told my mom she could not come to the Jamie XX rave.
Lorelei, how you doing? This is Mom. I wanted to confirm you that, yes, I'm coming to the tonight. I will be there, my dear, okay? Thank you. I just wanted to confirm you.
I was sound checking, and she comes to the gate, and I didn't put her on the list. And the security comes up to me and is like, your mom's outside. And I'm like, oh, God. But it ended up being, like, really great. We got to hang out, and she got to experience something she's never experienced before. I mean, she didn't really like the music, to be honest. But she was, like, getting into it. I still get the same inspiration that I get when I hear Bjork now. I mean, since I was 13, I wasn't afraid to be my own person because of discovering artists like that. And I think art has a great deal to do with being yourself. You know, people from Honduras don't have that in their life. I mean, at least where my family is from, a lot of people don't have the privilege of having art. They don't have that freedom to just be like, I'm going to be myself, you know? I can't imagine what it's like for my mom when she sees me performing. I think she sees herself a lot. I don't know. That's what I hope. Maybe she sees, like, the opportunity that she's given me, you know?
That's Larly Rodriguez, who performs as Empress Of, and her mother, Reina. Thanks to Marlon Bishop and the public radio show Latino USA for that story. Maybe there's some piece of music or theater or cinema or a swan dress that made you rethink your career goals. If so, let us know at studio360.org and we might give you a call. Still ahead this hour?
I couldn't believe people were paying me to write, and I wasn't choosing jobs based on what they were. It was like I couldn't believe that somebody would pay me to write any script.
Terrence Winter wrote for The Sopranos and then created Boardwalk Empire. But before that...
Flipper sounded great and Xena sounded great, and they were.
Terrence Winter on how he went from dolphins and warrior princesses to rock and roll excess. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you are listening to Studio 360. So this is the golden age of television. Actually, it's the golden age of the anti-hero on television, in particular, the white middle-aged male anti-hero. Don Draper, Walter White, Tony Soprano, totally irredeemable characters who we root for anyhow. Terry Winter knows something about charismatic sociopaths. He wrote a couple of dozen episodes of The Sopranos. Then he created the terrific gangster series Boardwalk Empire, set during Prohibition. And he wrote Martin Scorsese's Wolf of Wall Street. His new series on HBO is called Vinyl. And for it, he created Richie Finestra, a drug-addled, financially stressed, middle-aged record mogul.
Now, assume an artist gets paid a dollar for every record sold, less recoupable expenses. So, sell a million records, that's $1 million. Not bad, right? But there's that word, recoupable.
That's Bobby Cannavale as Richie Finestra.
That means that no matter how many records they sell, the actual cost of producing that record always comes out of the artist's end. Physically manufacturing the record, touring costs, studio space, marketing, packaging. If a drummer drinks a Pepsi in the middle of recording that album, believe me, he's paying for it at a 700% markup. We really don't have any downside.
No. No, we practically break even on all the flops. But the hits, that's where we cash in big.
That is Ray Romano there at the end, who also stars in Vinyl. So Richie is having an existential crisis, and in the first episode alone, he smashes an iconic guitar, hoovers up cocaine, commits business fraud, and very much worse, all dreamed up by Terry Winter. Good to have you here, sir.
Hi. Happy to be here.
So tell me about the germ for Vinyl. Where did it come from, and where do Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger come in?
The germ of this started well before I got involved. In 1996, Mick Jagger approached Martin Scorsese, I believe in London, and pitched him on the idea of doing a version of, say, the movie Casino set in the world of rock and roll.
Huh. So really, Mick is not just in like a decorative attachment?
Not at all. No, this started with him. And he said, let's do this sweeping epic set in the world of rock and roll. And their idea was to follow one guy who ultimately became Richie Finestra. It was a record executive, just this 19-year-old kid, say, in 1959, his first job in the record business, and then stay with that character over the course of the next three or four decades. So you started in the doo-wop era, follow him through the British invasion into the 70s and stadium rock into new wave, punk, disco, hip-hop, all the way through gangster rap.
It was to be a feature?
It was to be a feature, huh. Yeah. And it was going to be a big Martin Scorsese epic. In 2007, they were still working on it. This is 11 years later. I had just written the pilot episode of Boardwalk Empire, and I just wrote Wolf of Wall Street. Martin Scorsese called me up and said, listen, I have this other thing. It's this movie set in the world of rock and roll. I'm doing it with Mick Jagger. Do you think you'd be interested in something like that? So
Mick Jagger invented this series. Is he involved in an ongoing way? Does he hang around the set? Does he read scripts? How does that work?
He is involved very much so. He and Martin Scorsese together are very, very hands-on here. I mean, Mick, you know, due to his touring schedule, is often not physically present.
Oh, yeah. He's in a band.
Yeah. He's got a little side gig he does. But he actually sat in with us in the writer's room a couple of days, which was pretty incredible for me and my writers. And when Mick had gotten there, he got me on the side and said, what's going to happen in there? And I said, well, it's going to take about 15 minutes before people adjust to the fact that Mick Jagger is sitting across from them. And once they do, we just start to talk. It's just really just storytelling and riffing. And at that point, we were talking about the idea of Richie and Devin, his wife, living in suburbia and kind of being alienated there. And, on paper, that's what you do when you're successful. You move out and get a big house in the suburbs. And then, of course, if you're a city person, that might not be the best thing. And, you know, within a few minutes, Mick started sharing stories about, you know, himself and the idea that, you know, he had a big country estate outside of London and, you know, sitting out there and feeling kind of bored and thinking, you know, I thought this is what I was supposed to do, and he really wanted to get back to the city. And he just became one of the other writers telling stories and laughing, and it was just really, really easy and fun and natural.
Can I look at the tapes of those?
We don't tape anything. Otherwise, people would never say anything revealing.
And did he make you hire his kid?
Not at all.
Who was a not insignificant actor in the show?
No, I mean Marty cast the pilot, and from what I understand, Mick said, you know, when the part called for a, you know, young punk rock singer, Mick said, "Look, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that my son James is in a punk rock band."
Oh, really? That said, so that's real?
Oh, yeah, totally. He said, "If you'll see him, that'd be great." No pressure whatsoever. James came and met with Marty, read with Juno Temple, and he's absolutely terrific. You know, he could not be better on the show. He is that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's
really? He's a jerk?
He's that punk rocker.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There is also beautiful period production design, and it's a period that I lived through, so I love it all the more for that reason. There is one particularly amazing piece, which is the ravaged graffiti-covered subway cars and subway station, New York subways aren't like that anymore.
No.
So did you – and that must have been a very expensive ruin to create.
That was created digitally. That
oh,
was
really?
Done by our incredible
oh,
visual effects supervisor, Leslie Robeson Foster.
Wow, that's impressive in that case.
That train was pristine.
And the station.
And the station as well.
Wow.
And that's all done with visual effects. Well, and that's the interesting thing. I mean, usually you use visual effects to make things look better.
Yes.
On our show, we needed it to make buildings look decrepit. And
No, it made me laugh. It made me want to show that scene to my children.
Yeah.
This was really the way it was.
Absolutely. I remember back then, if a clean train would show up, people would look at each other and go, what's happening?
Before you were a creator of TV shows and screenwriter and a writer, you were a New York lawyer.
Yes.
Was there a precipitating event that made you chuck that?
I should not have been in law school in the first place. Law school for me was a way of avoiding what I really wanted to do and was too scared to do, which was be a TV writer.
Oh, you knew that already?
I am deep in my heart, I did, yeah. And I just didn't have the balls to pursue it. It was just something that I just couldn't imagine. I mean, you didn't know anybody in Brooklyn growing up in the 70s who had anything to do with the film business. And it just seemed so ludicrous to even dream about. It's funny, a good friend of mine, when we were in law school together, we were sharing an apartment and we were watching TV one night, and he said, you know, if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? Now, you would hope that two people in law school, the answer would be a lawyer. But even then, we were planning on doing something else. And I said, well, very tentatively, I don't know, I guess I'd be like a writer for David Letterman or something. And he said, no, something realistic. And I remember thinking, I can't even dream about this. It's not even a realistic fantasy. So it was really hard for me to finally – confronted out loud. And ultimately what happened is I just got so unhappy after a couple of years of practicing law, and I just knew it wasn't for me. I just didn't want to go to work anymore. And I just finally one day just said, I have to do this.
And you wrote for Flipper.
You wrote for
Xena Warrior Princess.
My standards were very high. In order for me to take a job, you had to say, do you want this job?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I
yeah.
would say, yes, I
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't believe people were paying me to write. And I wasn't choosing jobs based on what they were. It was like I couldn't believe that somebody would pay me to write any script. And Flipper sounded great and Xena sounded great, and they were.
And it wasn't that long, 5 or 6 years, I guess, before Sopranos came along.
My agent at the time sent me a VHS tape and said, I want you to watch this pilot. It's called The Sopranos. And, of course, I thought, opera, great. Why me?
Yeah.
He said, just watch it. And I don't even think I finished it. And I called him back. I said, you have got to get me on this show. I knew guys like that. I actually worked for a butcher shop in Brooklyn that was owned by Paul Castellano when I was a teenager.
Huh.
And
who was, listeners, a famous gangster.
Yeah, the head of the Gambino crime family. And, I just sort of by osmosis sort of, you know, knew how those guys talked and acted and just understood that world. And I was a huge fan of, you know, mob movies and read all the books and all that stuff. So
have you – you've written screenplays. You wrote The Wolf of Wall Street. But do you think of yourself as happier, better, whatever-er at television series writing, making than feature film writing?
I really like the idea of telling a long story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great luxury to live with characters over the course of dozens of episodes and to create a universe and a backstory and worlds. And it's really satisfying. Films are writing a film is much more challenging. It's sort of, you know, the greatest hits of that person's life. I always talk about the Al Capone. You know, every movie you've seen of Al Capone is always the cigar chomping guy at the height of his power. And we had such a luxury on Boardwalk Empire to start with the Al Capone, nobody knew, the chubby kid driving the other guy's car, and to go home with Al Capone. And, you know, if you, those scenes with Al Capone and his deaf son, if you had that in your movie, they'd say, well, those that has to go. We got to get to the machine gun. You know, for me, that's so much more interesting.
Totally. So you've shot the entire season before anybody has seen one.
Right.
Was that true of Boardwalk Empire as well?
Yeah. And that's an enormous luxury as a storyteller to have the whole piece done and to see it. And, you know, on occasion you'd go back and backfill in a scene or a moment or tweak something.
It's like writing a novel. Makes sense.
Yeah, which is great.
And you don't have to, as happens, as you know better than I, in television, regular series television all the time, writers and producers respond to how the audience is reacting to characters.
Right.
Do you miss that, or is
no,
it good not to have to?
Oh, I don't want that at all. No.
To hell with the audience and what they want.
Yeah, not so much that as it is. You know, somebody's got to be in charge of telling the story, and I'm going to do that, and I hope you like it.
Yes.
You know, otherwise, I mean, I'm always mystified when I read about showrunners who tweet with the audience, and the audience tells them what they want to see, and then they do it, and it's just like a puppet show or something, and I'm not sure who's steering that ship.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's like I really, truly hope audiences like what I'm doing, and we all do. But you know, and I guess if they don't, I won't have a job very long.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to let the audience dictate what the story should be. Otherwise, it's a completely different thing.
Hear, hear. and all I know is that with so much to watch today that's good or might be good or is great, my wife and I watched this 2-hour pilot yesterday, and we both said, so I guess we got to add this to the menu too. So that's a measure of something.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry to impose on you for 10 more hours, but I hope you'll be happy.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed it a lot. Terry Winter, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great being here.
Vinyl debuts on HBO on February 14th. So you're walking through Home Depot and a guy walks by. He's mid-60s by the looks of him, wearing, say, Dockers, and you think, wait, do I know that guy? James Williamson is that guy. He's a successful tech executive. He's been working in Silicon Valley almost since it was first called that. But what he did before that in the 1970s is a very big deal. And it turns out that most people in his life, including his own children, had no clue. Judy Campbell has the story.
Jimmy Williamson is in his 30s, and he knows a lot more about his dad, James Williamson, than he did when he was a kid. Back then, growing up in a beautiful house in a leafy Silicon Valley suburb, his father would go off to work every morning, just like everyone else.
You know, my dad's an engineer working like a 9-to-5 type of shift, and my mom was mostly like a homemaker at that time. So it was, I guess, typical, just in a lot of ways.
His dad had hobbies.
Tennis and fishing that, you know, that we shared together. And you know, he goes on his walks and jogs, and now he's into golf.
Growing up, Jimmy had sort of a vague sense that his father used to be involved with music. Then one day, when he was about 13, he was listening to his favorite album, Nevermind by Nirvana, when his father poked his head in his door and had something to say.
You know, that's all right, but, you know, I was the one who kind of created all of this.
What did you think?
I didn't really believe him, no, and I thought that he, you know, I thought that he was kind of joking, really.
No joke. I'm a sleepwalking cheater with a hat full of napalm. Turns out, James Williamson was the guitarist in the iconic proto-punk band The Stooges in the 1970s. But most people around James Williamson had no idea about his past. Iggy and The Stooges, they were wild. Iggy Pop was all over the stage, writhing, diving, flailing. And I know at this point it's a little cliché to say that a punk rock band was wild, but Iggy invented that cliche. He was the first person to stage dive. He'd moon the crowd or flash them. Sometimes he was covered in peanut butter, sometimes in his own blood. James wasn't with the band from the beginning, but he knew them, and he was at their first gig in Detroit in 1968. James was a teenager. He'd already been kicked out of several schools, spent some time in juvie hall, and he was in a band. But he'd never seen or heard anything like this. Iggy was covered in silver paint, playing a vacuum cleaner. James says it was sort of horrible, but also totally exhilarating.
I mean, how exciting is the vacuum cleaner? But there was enough drug consumption at that place that it really didn't matter.
This all appealed to James. He'd mostly taught himself how to play guitar.
I learned early on that it was easier to write my own music than it was to copy other people's music.
So he had this guitar style that didn't sound like anyone else. Iggy liked it. And so after a couple of years, he invited him to join the band. It was fun and crazy and hard. So many drugs, total poverty, living like outlaws. And then a break. Iggy befriended David Bowie, a big fan, who helped him get signed to Columbia Records. Bowie and Iggy were going to London, and Iggy wanted James with him to make an album.
So here we are, these Midwest kind of bumpkin guys, never been out of the country before, you know, didn't know anything. But we were really sure of ourselves, you know.
So sure of themselves, they didn't bother taking the cues of the music industry backing them, which was enthralled at the time with glam. But they were staying raw. James sat in his London bedroom with an acoustic guitar and wrote all the songs for what became the album Raw Power. The lyrics are Iggy's, and it's his band. But that sound, the purposeful distortion, the intensity, so many chords, so fast, a guitar brutal and technical, that's James. That's why Iggy brought him to London, to create a new sound. By then, David Bowie was hitting it big in the U.S. That kept the label guys distracted, and the Stooges were left alone to make this very unconventional album.
That's the only way we could have ever made that record because it's just had no commercial appeal whatsoever.
To really get this, I'm going to play the number one song in the States that year. We'll tie a yellow ribbon around the old tree. Got that difference? Here's another song from Raw Power.
Nothing sounded like this. Nothing.
My friend Kevin Jones is a music writer, and he says it can be hard now to get what a big deal Raw Power was, because so much music ended up sounding like this. He brings up that famous Brian Eno quote about the Velvet Underground's first album. Eno said, basically, that not many people bought the album, but everyone who did started a band.
Now, that's pretty cool, because that's definitely what Raw Power was. But unlike the Velvet Underground first album, like, everyone who started a band after hearing Raw Power, like, change music history. We're talking The Clash, The Sex Pistols, The Damned, The Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nirvana.
Hear that, Jamie? Nirvana.
James invented the sound, and even the people that followed him really couldn't recreate it.
But at the time, it was new and weird. The world wasn't ready for the Stooges. Raw Power was a flop.
It plummeted like a rock.
Being ahead of your time sounds so cool in retrospect, but it was a big pain when it was happening. Their tour in the U.S. was a disaster. James called it a death march. The band's drug use was out of control, and Iggy was getting grosser on stage, vomiting, spitting on the audience, taking his pants off. In one show, Iggy got cut with glass, and he went with it. Blood gushed, covering him. He kept playing. And it got even worse, with fans hurling bottles and lit cigarettes at the stage. Finally, the band imploded. Iggy ended up on the streets, wrung out by his heroin habit, and he kept clawing his way back. He needed it, success or no. But James, not too long after the breakup, he put down his guitar. Let's jump to 1977. It's been about 3 years since the Stooges broke up, and James has been working in the music industry, in production, recording albums for bands he hated, mostly disco.
I think that's what led to my happening to be at an electronics store when I saw my first personal computer.
It was a revelation.
It was called the MSI 8080, and it had little switches on the front panel where you had to boot it up in binary, you know, to get anywhere with it.
At no time in our conversation about music, touring, writing Kurt Cobain's favorite all-time album, did James light up the way he did when he talked about seeing his first computer.
The personal computer was like exciting in a way that rock and roll had used to be for me.
By the next year, he was in college, studying to be an engineer. This is a guy who went to 5 high schools. He had not done well in school. It was hard, but he loved it. He kept going, plugging away. And when he graduated in 1982, he moved to Silicon Valley for an engineering job. He got married, had 2 kids, and he became a huge success. Huge. He worked his way all the way up to vice president of technology standards at Sony Electronics, a major tech exec. And he kept mum about his former life. He'd moved on.
Music to me is like all consuming. And so when I was stopped playing music, I had to just put it down. Otherwise, it was too hard for me to do both things.
So 3 decades go by without music. And then Iggy called.
He wants to know if I want to rejoin the band.
Join the band for a world tour of the old songs.
And I'm like, no. You know, because at that point, I mean, I'm fat, dumb, and happy. I don't really need the band.
But this was 2009. The economy had been tanking. Sony started offering early retirement to some of the older people in the company, including James. So his son Jamie says his dad held a family meeting.
You could tell he was nervous.
But he got back on the guitar and started practicing nonstop for 6 months.
Good thing, because the first show was Sao Paulo, Brazil for 40,000 people, you know. It was like crazy.
So remarkably bigger than anything you had ever played in the day.
Oh, yeah, it was not even close. And so it was like I just stepped right into, you know, this like, you know, big time entertainment situation.
And he killed it. James's guitar sounded just like the old days, not just the notes, that energy, the excitement, the verge of insanity thrill.
You don't really lose that stuff, it just lays dormant.
I was like, okay, I get it. I get why these people are so excited. And like, I, you know, I really like this music too. And I'm just like really thrilled that he's out there doing it. And I'm really proud of him.
So what does a guy in his mid-60s with a 3-decade break from music look like on stage? Well, pretty tame, really. I watched a video of one of his shows during their 5-year world tour. He's wearing a t-shirt and a black leather jacket, but it's one of those leather jackets that looks like a blazer, nothing like the vampire jumpsuit he used to wear. And he stands there and plays. Iggy is all over the stage, half naked, but James is laser-focused on his guitar. Always the technician. Be it guitar or computer.
Judy Campbell is co-host of KQED's podcast, The Leap, and you can hear a longer version of her story there. James Williamson is once again recording music. His most recent album is called Relick. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. We'll have a new show next week. Meantime, you can find us on Twitter. The team is at Studio 360 Show, and I'm at KB Anderson. That's with an E-N. And follow us on Facebook as well, because if you don't, you'll miss delights such as a recent post about women dyeing their hair to match famous paintings, such as The Scream and Starry Night. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yelidi,
Kate Essig,
Zakia Gibbons.
Special thanks this week to Dan O'Donnell and Seth Sandler. And one last thing. This week, we say goodbye to one of our producers, Lynn Levy. I already miss her. Our theme music is by David Van Tee.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, romance with a big dose of realism.
So when somebody calls me and says, you know, my husband left me last year and I just met this wonderful man. Our divorce has been final 2 weeks and I'm ready to get married again. I'm like, no, no, don't do that.
I'll talk with the radio host Delilah, queen of relationship advice and sappy love songs. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.